loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, sitting in for co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk with Abby Martin and Mike Preisner of the Empire Files. U.S. economic sanctions against Venezuela have led to the at least temporary suspension of this great documentary show, The Empire Files. It's also part of a larger war against alternative media and against progressive media. We're going to talk about all of those issues with Abby Martin and Mike Preisner. And then we continue our weekly series every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Today we focus on the NAFTA deal, what it means for working people in the United States, in Mexico, in Canada, and what comes next.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, despite being caught in a lie, CNN is standing behind their reporting. Lanny Davis, a lawyer for former President Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen, told CNN as an anonymous source that Cohen had details on the Trump Tower meeting that special counsel Robert Mueller is keen to find out about. He told several other outlets after that, but in the past few days, he's been saying Cohen doesn't necessarily have that information. Next, Donald Trump tweeted this morning criticizing Google's manipulation of search results. While his outrage was directed at their reported suppression of right-wing outlets, beneath the surface are huge implications about Google's power and ability to surveil virtually every part of our lives. Then, Chemnitz, a German city in the state of Saxony, has erupted in racist rioting and violence in the last few days, with crowds yelling anti-immigrant slogans and using the illegal Nazi straight arm salute, facing off with other crowds of anti-racist protesters. What does this mean for the rise of the far right in Germany and in Europe as a whole? And then, the Russian defense minister today announced that huge military drills involving hundreds of thousands of soldiers will take place in the country's east next month. With a sizable contingent of Chinese troops expected to participate, many are taking this as a sign that the two rising powers are moving closer together in response to the U.S. government's new doctrine of, quote, major power conflict. And finally, Iran's parliament censured President Hassan Rouhani today and referred him to the judiciary. This comes shortly after the ministers of economy and labor were fired by lawmakers. What's going on in Iran's government, and what role do U.S. sanctions play? And in other headlines, a federal court ruled this week that the new district lines in North Carolina are indeed gerrymandered to benefit Republicans. This suggests that new lines should be drawn and implemented before November's midterm elections. French Environment Minister Nicolas Hulot resigned live on a radio interview today in protest of President Macron's pro-corporate policies and his lack of progress on key environmental issues. Hulot is well-liked among younger French voters, and he had a nature TV show that was popular in the 1990s. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort was in talks for a plea deal on his second set of charges in a trial that is set to begin next month. That's according to new reports. These talks apparently stalled, and the first step of the trial, jury selection, has been set for September 17th. Manafort went to trial on his first set of charges this summer and was convicted on 8 of them, but the jury was hung on the remaining 10. Turkish President Erdogan and Russian President Putin will meet Iranian President Rouhani next month in Tabriz in Iran's East Azerbaijan province to continue to discuss the war in Syria. Turkey, Russia, and Iran are the original group of three nations that participated in the Astana peace process talks. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the status of the Empire Files, hosted by Abby Martin. Progressive alternative media in the United States and in the hemisphere are under attack. Recently, the prominent Telesur program, the Empire Files, was shut down as a consequence of U.S. sanctions imposed on Venezuela. Meanwhile, Facebook and other social media giants have been censoring and concealing content that does not fit the corporate media narrative. We're joined from Los Angeles by Abby Martin. She is the host of The Empire Files, and by Mike Preisner, the producer of that show, The Empire Files. You can support their ongoing work at patreon.com/ Empire Files and GoFundMe.com/keep-empire-files-going. We're going to go over that so people can show their support later in the show. Abby Martin, Mike Preisner, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
Abby, this is obviously for the people watching your show, and there's a lot of them all over the world, not just in the United States, a really, really big blow because there's so little progressive content, factually based content of the caliber and quality that you produced, you and Mike Preisner and others are producing on Empire Files. Just tell the audience what happened.
Right. I mean, you're absolutely right, Brian. We're living in a pretty abysmal state of journalism right now where to challenge this corporate tyranny and imperialist regime change narratives from the U.S. empire, you have to go outside that corporate media apparatus. And that's really hard to do and get funding for that. So Telesaur, of course, has been a target of attack. I mean, you can go back through all of the coup attempts from the U.S.-backed opposition all the way until the Obama administration in 2015 when sanctions were actually first implemented against Venezuela, when he deemed, oddly enough, Venezuela a national security threat, kind of out of the blue, maybe because they have the largest oil reserves in the world. But it didn't actually escalate to the point of kind of seizing Telesaur's ability to function until after the Democratic re-election, that landslide re-election of Maduro back in May. Of course, the Venezuelan people, again, were punished for choosing the wrong leader, quote-unquote, that the U.S. empire didn't want. So they slapped inordinate sanctions on them that you have not seen in the region actually since Nicaragua in the 1980s when we were waging a full-blown bloody war against the Nicaraguan people. And as much as they want to say these sanctions affect, you know, corrupt government officials, that's absolutely untrue. Sanctions do exactly as they're intended to do. They affect the poor, vulnerable, working-class people, affecting food and medicine from getting to the poorest people of Venezuela. So collateral damage of this latest round of sanctions was seizing the ability for Telesaur to pay any contract journalists. And that's been the result of the last 6 months, Brian. We've been waiting for 6 months. I mean, Tariqa Lee's show is in the same boat as ours, where we've basically had not been able to receive payments in and out of Caracas, and not just Caracas, but every single other allied country that links up with Telesaur. So the U.S. government has completely disabled Telesaur's ability to pay journalists and to receive funding or loans, of course, from outside of the country. So that's where we are today, and this is kind of a backhanded attempt, a happy circumstance for the Trump administration, because of course Telesaur is one of the few programs that is really challenging this corporate media hegemony, which of course is why Telesaur was created in the first place, as a joint project by Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez, to challenge that regime change narrative that was assaulting their countries and trying to overthrow their leaders. So here we are, where we're now having to, you know, ask for donations to keep this show going. We're overwhelmed with the amount of support, and we can't thank you enough for having us on, Brian, to talk about it.
That's the voice of Abby Martin. We're also talking with Mike Preisner about the Empire Files. They're excellent show, documentary films, 30 minutes, amazing, high quality, high caliber, where they have gone all over the world documenting stories that are vital, that are key to people's real understanding of global politics. And the stories that are never reported, or if they are reported in the corporate-owned media, are reported such that they can only be considered disinformation. Well, let's just call it, let's use another word, lies. And so, you know, Abby, I know you only have a few minutes with us before you have to run, and we truly appreciate your joining us. I want to go back and spend another minute or two on this topic about the point that you made in the beginning. If you want to tell the truth, if you want to dominate or oppose the dominant narrative of the elites, you have to go outside the sort of media apparatus of the elites. And when you were talking, it reminded me of that very famous quote from Karl Marx, the ideas of any society are the ideas of its ruling class. And that was true in the slave societies of antiquity or the feudal societies where the kings and queens and their priests dominated and informed public opinion. Also true right now in the so-called free world where we have the rights of individuals. the ideas of any society are the ideas of its ruling class. And yet people in their yearning for change, in their sort of organic desire to resist injustice, they keep looking for the truth. And it seems to me that's why, one, the Empire Files was so popular and is so popular, and also why the powers that be would consider it such a dire threat, almost like an existential threat. Just talk about the kind of shows that you've covered.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I, just for some context, I mean, we're talking about a whole broader campaign on behalf of the government working with these tech companies that are curating our reality for us. You know, they're deeming us not critical thinkers enough to actually discern what is disinformation and what is not. So they're telling us for us, these tech companies are preemptively basically censoring the internet, backpaging Russian media, backpaging state media, and all left media has been enormously affected by this wave of fake news hysteria, as we see everything from Sputnik to Counterpunch to Truthdig to Black Agenda Report. So we're all the targets here. But I mean, and the Senate Judiciary Committee basically begged these tech companies to do it preemptively without even a law being implemented. So it's very scary, and it really blurs the line of censorship and free press here. But you know, this show is very crucial, Brian. We look through the lens of the U.S. empire when it really comes to any issue domestically and internationally, because we cannot really look at any issue in the world right now without that lens. How does the U.S. empire shape kind of the colonized versus the colonizers? Every issue in the world can be seen through this lens. And then in the domestic front, of course, you're looking at just the ridiculous amount of military spending. Of course, the increase alone this year is more than Russia's entire military budget. So, yes, whether it be police brutality, whether it be, you know, Saudi Arabia, all of these things can be seen. How is the U.S. empire affecting the situation? And as we know, you know, with 800 military bases plus the lily pads that the Pentagon can't even account for, the militarism has expanded its tentacles throughout literally almost every single nation on Earth. And so what effect does that have? So we've been able to go everywhere from the U.S.-Mexico border to talk about this unreported refugee crisis on our doorstep, where there's literally hundreds of bodies being found in the desert every year. This was through the Obama administration, since the Clinton administration. We've covered the environmental disasters in the Amazon rainforest, where Chevron just left hundreds of millions of barrels of oil to rot and was completely not held accountable for that. I mean, we've gone on the ground in Venezuela to show the regime change operations there, embedded ourselves in the protests. I mean, we went in Palestine and we showed, you know, a series of documentaries from everything from how these settlements work to the settler terrorism. It was an incredible experience, Brian, and that's why Telesaur is so imperative. It's so crucial to maintain and to support and to have solidarity for this network because, again, I mean, it was started as this joint venture to counter this corporate hegemony that really dominates the narrative in almost every single Western country here. So Empire Files was an ability for us to have this investigative documentary series where we've been able to do a deep dive with really no editorial control at all, no interference at all. And that's what really bothers me when I hear people, and I'm sure you feel the same way, oh, this is a Putin propaganda mouthpiece. Oh, you're paid to lie by the Maduro regime. I mean, it's insulting as someone who's risked their life to tell the truth, as someone who's put their job on the line to tell the truth. We will do everything we can to keep telling the truth about these issues. And Telesaur is just so crucial. And of course, that's why it's demonized. Of course, that's why state media is a target, because they want to paint everything as disinformation that doesn't just go center of the road and push that bipartisan foreign policy agenda of endless war and militarism, Brian. And that's why they're cracking down. And this is coming after these censorship bans and these age-sensitive content warnings through Telesaur. So I think this is part and parcel with an entire regime change narrative, because, you know, we're talking about an assassination attempt that was just almost killed Maduro with C4 explosives that is tracked back to Miami and Bogota. So that's where we are right now. And we have to keep the show alive, and we have to keep challenging the establishment and the empire before it's too late, Brian.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Abby Martin. She's the host of the Empire Files, and Mike Preisner, who's the producer of that show. You can support their work, help them resist these attacks on progressive journalism by going to patreon.com/empirefiles or gofundme.com/keep-empire-files-going. Abby, we know you have to leave in just a minute, but I wanted to ask you one final question. You know, there's the complete blackout of information. There's the de facto banning of certain programs, like what happened to your program as a consequence of these sanctions. But there's another way that progressive and alternative voices are censored, and that's through these big search engines or social media platforms effectively manipulating the algorithm so that people just don't see content that falls outside of the mainstream media's narrative. I'm looking at a report from fair.org. It's saying that Alternet's Google traffic fell by 63%, Media Matters by 42%, Truth Out by 25%. I mean, that's just as dangerous as the banning of programs, right?
Absolutely. And I wanted to mention really quickly that I didn't say before, we're about to produce a series of documentaries about the Great March of Return from Gaza, and so that's where some of the money will be going for. But absolutely, Walter, you know, as I mentioned, I mean, the Senate Judiciary Committee basically asked Facebook, Google, and Twitter last year to drop a mission statement to, quote, prevent the foment of discord. Now, whatever that vague, bizarre statement means is really up to the interpretation of whoever is curating our reality. Again, and you look at who's actually doing this. Think tanks like the Atlantic Council, who's stacked with defense contractors, U.S. military branches, oil companies, CIA officials, spooks, cops. This is who's working with tech companies to deem what is sowing discord or what is low-quality content or what provokes violence. I mean, what is the difference between what Alex Jones was doing and what Fox News is doing on a daily basis to gin up hysteria against immigrants, Muslims, and basically parade around defense contractors to sell the next military intervention that's going to cost another million lives? This Google stuff is amazing because you see just you know, ad nauseum all day about Google censoring China at the behest of the Chinese government. What exactly is different about Google taking the preemptive initiative to literally censor and curate our search algorithms with this black box algorithm when you look everything from Hamilton 68 dashboard that doesn't reveal its methodology to determine what is Russian trolls or disinformation, to Google, that basically has already deplatformed all left media, all alternative media. You can't even find the truth on Google search results unless you go wade through about 20 pages here. So, yes, our reality has already been predetermined by tech companies that for some reason we feel are altruistic, I guess because they had the mantra, don't be evil. I mean, I don't know why we're trusting people like Mark Zuckerberg to curate and be the purveyor of what the hell reality is. We already know that they completely acquiesced to Israel as well. I mean, just on Facebook alone, this think tank Atlantic Council and Mark Zuckerberg working with the Israeli government, and he's basically complied with 95% of their requests to take down Palestinian pages that quote-unquote sow discord. So when I see people like Chris Murphy, a sitting senator, saying InfoWars is the tip of the iceberg. The companies must do more to take down one website. The survival of our democracy depends on it. I'm very, very skeptical of that as someone who has written up in the DNI report as part of this Russiagate narrative, as someone who was, quote-unquote, fomenting radical discontent with my prior show at RT. That's a really slippery slope. That's a very slippery slope because, again, they're going to go after anyone who basically just throws a wrench in that centrist agenda that they want to basically corral all of the energy that's against Trump into this establishment Russiagate narrative to just cement the next Democratic candidate, because that's really what they care about at the end of the day.
That's the voice of Abby Martin. Abby is the host of Empire Files. She's talking to us from Los Angeles. We're also joined by Mike Preisner. Abby Martin, thank you so much for taking the time out to join us. We're going, again, of course, to tell people how they can support your work and the work of Mike Preisner and the work, the journalistic work, the essential journalistic work that both of you and others are carrying out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Mike Preisner, let's bring you in. You are the producer of The Empire Files. The program is so wonderful, and you know, you're on the front lines. You go where the action is, and obviously at great danger in several instances. Just talk a little bit about how you make the movies, how you make those documentaries, how big is your staff? It seems the quality and caliber seems so high, but I think you actually have a small staff. And Abby mentioned that you're preparing other documentaries about the Great March of Return. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, the staff has been different size at different times, of course. You know, we've been dealing with these issues related to the sanctions since 2015 when we started the show, and actually when sanctions on Venezuela began. And so there's been periodic times where we've been able to have, you know, many full-time editors and videographers and audio engineers. But over the past, I would say, year, because of the, you know, extreme difficulty really resulting in long-term delayed payments, the staff has dwindled down to myself and Abby, an audio engineer, John Preisner, my brother, and some other people on the team who help out from time to time. But, you know, really the core of the work is really going on the ground to different places where we, you know, we'll work with videographers on the ground and try to get the story that's not coming out and think are going on in the world today. But also interviews with people who we feel are voices that need to be heard. And of course, really getting in depth into educational documentaries that cover narratives that, you know, we don't really hear, like the people's history, the workers' history of different struggles from around the world. And so, you know, recently we hired a team of journalists in Gaza. There's six incredible journalists in Gaza who have been going out and risking their lives at the border fence for the Great March of Return, because that was we had our eyes on that as our next you know, feature series of documentaries we were doing. And so they've filmed incredible footage, never before seen footage of brutality by the Israeli snipers at the border fence and real acts of heroism by medics and journalists and protesters there. So that's really what we're focused on now, getting out of the show is we have, you know, many hours of footage that are unreleased, both from Gaza and from being on the ground in Colombia with the FARC and the FARC peace zones, which, of course, we know are now under severe threat with the far right party winning the last presidential election in Colombia just weeks ago. And so the initial fundraising is to be able to complete post-production on these different things, both from Gaza and both the on-the-ground investigation in Colombia with the FARC. And so that's kind of what our sites are zeroed in on right now. But beyond that, you know, it's really unclear where we're going to be able to go.
That's the voice of Mike Preisner. He's the producer of The Empire Files. We were joined earlier on this segment by Abby Martin, the host of The Empire Files. Empire Files is because of sanctions directed against Venezuela by the United States, the economic war directed against Venezuela and against alternative media. The Empire Files, at least temporarily, has been suspended, but you can support the work of Abby Martin and Mike Preisner and others to keep this work going by going to patreon.com/empirefiles and gofundme.com/keep-empire-files-going. Mike Preisner, you were there in Palestine. What did you witness?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, for myself, you know, I had been interested in the issue of Palestine for maybe 10 years by the time we went with the Empire Files. And I think that the biggest impact that it left on me, I mean, we weren't able to get into Gaza because the Israeli press corps deemed us Iranian spies. And so we were not allowed press credentials to go into Gaza. Of course, they don't want people seeing it who they believe will report it critically. But for the month that we spent there in the West Bank, I mean, I think that the thing for people to know who follow the issue and might not realize is that the impact and level of the occupation forces on the Palestinian people is just so crushing. I mean, every single second you're in the West Bank, you see Israeli soldiers harassing people, you see checkpoints, you see long lines of people being brutalized and harassed and humiliated for no reason at all. I mean, it really was. I mean, it's in the same way that the occupation of Iraq was just a constant, dominating, horrible thing to the Iraqi people. It's at the same level in Palestine.
Mike, what you and Abby and your team are doing is really a crucial part of the political struggle, of the struggle for power in society. I mean, we live in a country and in a world dominated by a tiny, tiny handful of extremely wealthy people. I mean, in the United States, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett, three guys, they have as much money as the poorest half of the U.S. population. That's about 160 million people. And in the final analysis, I mean, the way that they can keep all that wealth and power and money is through force. I mean, it's through the police, it's through the army, it's through, you know, the prisons. But it's much better for them if they don't have to resort to the police and the army and the prisons. It's much better if they can just convince people that how society is structured, the way things are going is basically okay. And so
or unchangeable.
Or unchangeable, right? Or God-given, right? In a previous iteration of human society, we had this idea of the divine right of kings. Now we have sort of bootstraps ideology, right? That rich people are rich because they're just smarter and work harder than the rest of us. So, I mean, what you're doing in the big picture is really part of this essential political struggle in society. Talk about that. I mean, talk about how the work of progressive and alternative journalists, of radical journalists like yourself, relate to, you know, the on-the-ground organizing, how it sort of provides ammunition.
Sure. Well, you know, of course, it's always been important. And it's like, you know, to challenge the ideas of the ruling class. I mean, we have to do it in their arenas, be it elections when people are paying attention to elections, or challenging them by building our own media structures. I think it become increasingly a battleground lately, because so many people, especially young people, have turned to alternative sources of their news. In fact, you know, I'm not sure what the ratings are for outlets like CNN and Fox, but I would imagine that it's quite low compared to, you know, 10 years ago of who would go to them for media. And so there's this acknowledgement that web-based media outlets, alternative-based media outlets are really the go-to for a new generation of people, especially people who are interested in politics in particular, knowing that that's where you need to go. You need to go to alternative sources to get it. And so that's why I feel like there's been this intensified focus recently, especially as the political crisis heightens and there's different as social movements grow, of course, this battleground becomes more pronounced. And so, for example, you know, we've been subject to different types of attacks for a while, like, you know, like these other subtle ways that they censor people, like age restrictions and warnings, you know, for example, our an episode that we have on socialism, you know, you have to sign in to be 18 or over to watch a video on socialism. And, you know, why does that make any kind of sense? And so then, you know, so for whether it's a domestic issue or whether it's an international one, you know, we know that people are going to be going to these sources for information, and that now the powers that be are trying to do what they can to stop it. And so I think that the removal of the kind of internet censorship, the removal of Telesaurus' Facebook page, and then simultaneously the removal of Venezuela Analysis's Facebook page, you know, two of the premier sources for what's going on the ground in Venezuela, coinciding with an assassination and coup attempt on the president. I mean, I think we have to realize that the media is more of a battleground than we think when it comes to what's going on here and around the world.
Mike Preisner is our guest. We were also joined by Abby Martin. Abby Martin is the host of The Empire Files and Mike Preisner, the producer. They have other documentaries in the works, including The Great March of Return, the peaceful protest movement in Palestine, in Gaza, that has been targeted by the Israelis with such brute force and murder. You can keep supporting the ongoing work of Abby Martin and Mike Preisner by going to patreon.com/empirefiles and gofundme.com/keep-empire-files-going. We really want to urge everyone to keep up the support. Don't let the powers that be take down alternative media, especially the media we rely on, like the Empire Files. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
It's Tuesday. That means we continue our weekly series that happens every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us every week on Tuesday from San Francisco. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we have a NAFTA without Canada. What's going on?
Yeah, so there's been some movement in the trade talks between the Trump administration, Mexico, and Canada. More specifically, Mexico and the Trump administration have signaled that they've reached a new trade deal that will essentially replace NAFTA as far as the U.S. and Mexico is concerned. And this is preliminary at this point. It looks like it will probably go through, but there is opportunity in theory for Congress to oppose it. That being said, the Republican-controlled Congress hasn't shown a huge will to do so at this time, so it seems unlikely that they will. This puts further pressure on Canada to come to the table and start acquiescing to U.S. demands that they get rid of certain tariffs and certain subsidies, because now the pressure is basically, hey, the U.S. and Mexico will go off with their own trade deal and you'll be left alone and you'll have to start from scratch without NAFTA. So, you know, Trump is hailing this as a big victory, but there's a lot of complexity to it that I think bears digging into. There's a lot of things that impacts, especially the automobile industry. that's really probably the industry that's impacted the most by this most recent round of discussions.
Yeah, we'll get into the details of the agreement in a moment, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on just sort of the political weirdness of this, right? I mean, so much of Donald Trump's like political identity, or at least you know, on the campaign trail in 2016 was anti-Mexican racism, but now when he's actually in office and doing diplomacy, it's pretty remarkable that they were able to reach an arrangement with Mexico before and maybe even to the exclusion of Canada, which of course has traditionally been in the U.S. camp.
And let's not forget to the exclusion of the incoming president of Mexico.
Yeah.
Which is why that clock got set, right, Daniel? I mean, he wanted to come to an agreement with Obrador. And this also shows you can come to an agreement with Mexico, maybe, or the outgoing discredited Mexican government and still practice, preach, promote anti-Mexican racism.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a really interesting and almost schizophrenic negotiation. Yes, I do believe that the reason they rushed this is because the current president will be out in November, and the new very popular further left-wing president will be coming to power then, amidst, you know, a huge popular upsurge in the Mexican people. And so the current president is just trying to shove it through. He's a lame duck at this point. It doesn't really matter. So he's going to kind of give stuff away. One of the most interesting things I found about it is the current administration in the United States is extremely anti-union, has passed numerous anti-union laws, trying to crush unions, roll back their strength, and is also, as you mentioned, extremely anti-Mexican, extremely nationalist and racist. And yet, a big part of this trade agreement requires that automakers in Mexico pay $16 an hour for the production of approximately 45% of the auto commodities created over there, and starts passing legislation that is more favorable to unions and allows for stronger collective bargaining laws, which is very odd because this America First rhetoric where, you know, U.S. citizens come before everyone else, it almost seems like he's pro-union and pro-Mexican workers in Mexico, but when it comes to workers in the United States, it's about smashing the unions and, you know, driving down wages. So I'm not exactly sure what to make of that. What people have theorized is that it's to try to get kind of pro-labor Democrats on board with it so that they'll look bad if they oppose it and offer their support to it. That could be. I also think the political climate in Mexico is moving further to the left. So there's more of a demand for, you know, worker-friendly policies. But that doesn't explain, you know, the current president can be tone deaf to those things. He's about to go out of the office anyway. So it's a really odd collection of things. And certainly the business class here in the United States opposes that entirely. Raising these wages is a huge cost to them. And really the whole incentive of bringing stuff to Mexico is because wages are extremely low. Workers have are weak relative to the United States. And there's fewer controls around safety and benefits and things like that in Mexico. So really, labor is just extremely cheap there by compared to the United States. So there's going to be a lot of very wealthy, very powerful lobbying firms that are going to be fighting this and seeking to get exceptions and seeking to get loopholes for them that we can anticipate to see in the near future.
When NAFTA was passed, it became law in January 1st, 1994. So that would be 24 years ago. There were a lot of different issues related to it. Of course, from the point of view of the Zapatistas, the indigenous people's representative in the southern state of Chiapas, who staged an uprising on January 1st, declaring that NAFTA was a death sentence for indigenous people, meaning farmers, small corn growers in the southern part of the state, because they would be undersold by U.S. agribusiness that could come in and undersell them, selling corn cheaper than they could produce. And then once they were driven out of business, which actually happened, corn prices were raised by the same agribusiness. That was one part of it. There was another part, which was that the labor movement in the United States, and this, again, is the Clinton administration, Democratic, presumably friendlier to labor. The main problem that the unions had was they weren't actually really consulted. They were kind of consulted in a token way. And, you know, trade, because it has such an impact on jobs, on wages, on benefits, on the environment, on communities where working people live, the labor movement, which isn't necessarily anti-free trade or pro-free trade, but it certainly wants to be at the table. They were basically excluded. That was the reason that they were angry. I saw the other day, Daniel, that the Trump administration at the last minute brought labor unions into the White House for a consultation so that they could sort of wink or nod or not complain about it. But again, it's treating labor as simply a category that must be noticed, but in a very, very tokenized way, so that working people whose lives are profoundly affected by these kind of trade agreements actually have no voice, and absent unions, they don't have any way to participate. It seems to me that that's a really big problem, and it's going to continue to be a problem, and that the labor movement, aside from its ultimate position on the issues of trade, free or not free trade, regular trade, fair trade, all the different language that connotes different sort of policy positions, if labor is excluded, then it's only the big bosses who get to determine everything, and their flunky politicians.
Yeah, and really, we need to be careful if we're advocating for the labor movement that we don't fall into this false dichotomy of, you know, pro-free trade or anti-free trade. And we also don't fall into the false dichotomy of Mexican workers versus U.S. workers, because both of those conflicts, in the end, no one wins. Workers lose out, and really the only people who win are the very, very wealthy. So when we look at these trade deals, we need to do that and keep that in mind. Donald Trump is the, you know, CEO, the president of the United States, and will represent the United States interests just the same as any other president before him. But it's really a matter of tactics, and he has some different tactics of how he wants to do it. So in this case, you know, the idea is to start forcing more manufacturing into the U.S., start making it less attractive to Mexico, start making it harder for capital to flow across the border. And the tokenism to the labor movement is just that, tokenism. It's, you know, it's trying to legitimize a presidency that by the vast majority of Americans is seen as very illegitimate. It's a way of trying to say, oh, no, we're not just about, you know, the very, very rich. We also care about union people because we let them come to the White House at the last minute and express a few thoughts to us. And it's a way of trying to make it look like, oh, no, this is everyone. This is all Americans. But the truth is, what we have right here and what is part of this negotiation are very powerful, wealthy business interests, both in Mexico and in the United States, fighting over who gets the piece of the pie, who gets the bigger piece, and how do they get the piece. And that's ultimately what we're seeing here. For the Trump administration, it's a very cynical thing. It's really about trying to fulfill the campaign promise that NAFTA is bad and we're going to negotiate something even better. So we'll throw a few token kind of crumbs here and there for people that are in his base who've watched their, you know, livelihoods kind of dissolve and fade away over the last 30 years or so. But the truth is, really, at the end, who's going to win in these agreements are very, very wealthy people in Mexico and in the United States.
Big businesses and the big banks put a very high premium on predictability and stability, though. I mean, I see what you're saying in terms of, you know, there can be a big payoff for the big banks and corporations, you know, if there are gambles, if there are renegotiations, if there are these sort of aggressive, bold, I guess you could call them, moves by the Trump administration. But there's also a big section of capital that is disturbed by these types of maneuvers, right? I mean, they think that, well, like, say, the TPP, right? The Trans-Pacific Partnership was going to be this huge multilateral trade deal that created, I think it would create the largest, quote-unquote, free trade zone in the world. And it was sort of a consensus position of all of the politicians, really, maybe with the exception of Donald Trump, but he happened to become the president. So the continuity, the consistency of policy that's followed by both parties, both Democrats and Republicans, that was kind of broken. So do you think that this is sort of viewed by some sectors of big business in that same light that, you know, maybe we get something out of it, but is it really worth the trouble? Is it really worth the unpredictability and instability?
Yeah, I think the signing of this or the near signing of this agreement creates some stability in that, you know, the very wealthy sectors of business have at least some idea of what's coming down the pipeline so they can prepare for it. That being said, I think a lot of businesses are taking advantage of this tariff situation. I think that in general, you know, the banking industry and the rest of the very wealthy do not like these tariffs and this trade war It hurts business. It creates instability. But I think there's also those that have come to kind of accept that this is sort of how this administration will operate and tries to take advantage of it. So, you know, you can have these trade deals signed, but you can also have very powerful lobbying firms that can step in and get special exceptions for certain businesses, certain sectors of industry, or some specific corporations. So, you know, one of the other articles, which we don't need to go into, was how an investment firm that invested in paper mills got some special exceptions for the paper mills that they invested in so that the tariffs wouldn't impact them as much. And so they were really able to undercut the competition, which was impacted by those tariffs. And so it was really just kind of cynically exploiting the tariffs for their advantage. I think more of the very wealthy, the bankers, are learning to do that and are trying to make maneuvers in that way. But I do believe, too, that this is really an upending of U.S. foreign policy of the last, 50, 60 years, which has basically said that free trade is the final goal, a sort of very minimal state capitalism where capital can move anywhere it wants to, whenever it wants to. And that's the end game. And this is kind of a rolling back of that a little bit and a renegotiation of these tariffs and trade deals. And so there is kind of an upset in the sort of typical Washington consensus that we're used to. And Trump represents a lot of that. And that's, I think, where the instability comes from. And that's where I think there's a lot of very powerful people that are very unhappy with how he's running things.
We're talking with Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. He's joining us from San Francisco. He joins the show every week, every Tuesday, for our regular series, False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Brian, go ahead. You were thinking about Chapter 11 of NAFTA.
Daniel, I want to ask you about Chapter 11, because it's a provision in NAFTA that I think almost no one knows about. But Chapter 11 of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, contains provisions designed to protect cross-border investors and facilitate the settlement of investment disputes. For example, each NAFTA party must accord investors from the other NAFTA parties national, that is, non-discriminatory treatment, and may not expropriate investments of those investors except in accordance with international law. Chapter 11 permits an investor of one NAFTA party to seek money damages for measures of one or of the other NAFTA parties that allegedly violate those and other provisions of Chapter 11. Now, when you unpack that, what they're basically saying is that the investors invest somewhere in North America, Mexico, Canada, the United States, with the idea that their investment will maximize their profit. And if there's any action taken by the host country where the investment is taking place that is to the detriment of, obstructs, prohibits, subverts maximizing profit, then they have a legal claim in basically investor state arbitrations. And the thing that this reminds me of is what happened when there was mass opposition to the Keystone Pipeline under Obama. And Obama eventually said, based on the need for an environmental impact study, they were going to delay the building of the Keystone Pipeline, which would bring all of this oil and from the tar sands oil, thick, dirty oil through the United States in a pipeline that will invariably break or leak. The company, and Walter, I can't remember the name of the Canadian company.
I think it's Energy Transfer Partners.
They actually used this Chapter 11 NAFTA to say the U.S. government didn't have the right to respond to the provision, the demands of the people not to have the pipeline because it limited their ability to maximize profits. I mean, that didn't end up actually being resolved through these arbitration courts, which are private, you know, secret, basically. Because Trump came in and said, no, we're going to have the Keystone Pipeline. So that's how the case ended. But that's a remarkable secret, undemocratic power, isn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, it's really a special secret court for investors. So me, an average citizen, if I feel like a corporation is taking advantage of me or not being fair, oh, let's say I'm worried about Ajit Pai rolling back net neutrality. Well, I'm out of luck. I guess I can go through the regular court system, which is complex and expensive, and I have very limited access to it. But if I'm an investor under the NAFTA Free Trade Agreement, I get a special court. The court is staffed with ex-lawyers who represented corporations. They almost always find in favor of the larger corporations and not in favor of the concerns of the state. And so one of the examples you have is Canada suing the United States for billions of dollars because their citizens didn't want to be poisoned by oil spills. And that's the sort of protection that NAFTA creates and affords. Now, what's interesting about this renegotiation is they are trying to remove that court system and instead have the legal battle settled in the nation's courts. We'll see if that part goes through, because this is really, as far as investors and the ultra wealthy are concerned, this is a really important part of NAFTA that they want to keep in there. They want their secret courts that are just kind of rubber stamps to allow them to sort of do whatever they want to make money at the without any sort of real state intervention. So we'll see if that part goes through. But even if it does, I kind of question whether U.S. courts in this case, let's say it was U.S. courts deciding about the tar sands, would do a whole heck of a lot better. They'd be a little better. But, you know, U.S. courts and Mexican courts have shown that they also support the interests of the ruling class and that they're going to come down heavily in favor of very wealthy investors over, you know, average citizens who are concerned about the tar sands or things like that. So I think, you know, it'll be a little rolling back of that, assuming it goes through. But I still think there's a huge uphill battle. I think that the general regular courts have overwhelmingly in support of the wealthy and also allow access from these particular groups much more easily than your average citizen. So I wouldn't, you know, hail it as some kind of a victory if it does go through, because there's still a lot of issues that remain unresolved.
Yeah, it's amazing how lopsided these types of agreements are. I mean, imagine if labor had access to the same forms of redress that capital does under these types of trade agreements. I mean, what if there was a supranational court that immigrants from Mexico could sue the Department of Homeland Security in because it infringes on their ability to provide for their family and live a decent life, or if homeless people in the United States could sue the U.S. government in a special court for failing to provide their basic human right to housing. I mean, maybe those things should exist, but they don't. But capital, but big business actually does have access under these trade agreements to institutions like that.
That's the voice of Walter Smolarek. Walter is co-hosting today's show. He's sitting in for John Kiriakou. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined from San Francisco by financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. He talks to us every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. You can also get hold of this segment every week by going to Spreaker.com. There's a Loud and Clear with Brian Becker interviews page, which will be able to give you just a particular section of the show. You can also listen to it at SputnikNews.com, or you can subscribe at iTunes.com. or at iHeartRadio, or now at Spotify. Daniel Sankey, go ahead.
So I think also some of the things that we should talk about when we look about this is how it's impacting, you know, our relationship kind of with Canada and the larger world. So one thing I mentioned earlier is really this trade agreement with Mexico is kind of being used as sort of to pressure Canada into agreeing to some of U.S. demands. One of the biggest ones is their protectionist measures around their dairy industry, which basically keeps the United States from flooding their industry with cheap milk and sort of doing to Canada what the U.S. did to corn farmers in Mexico that you talked about a little earlier. And, you know, Trudeau has said that this is a line in the sand. We won't go beyond this. We're going to protect our dairy industry. And so Trump is trying to pressure Canada into saying, well, fine, we're just going to go with Mexico and take our ball and go home. And then it'll be up to you. And the hope is that they'll get Canada to fold. You know, the United States is an empire. It's always extended its power through military means or economic means. So in a sense, pressuring other countries this way is not something novel. But what is new about this administration is the degree of aggressiveness and implacable kind of stubbornness in the face of countries that are really solid allies of the U.S. and really junior partners in its empire, such as Canada and the European Union. And what this is causing is really the start of some of these rifts between these countries to where they're going to really think twice about the U.S., that even if Trump gets voted out, even if this is his one and only presidential administration, they're going to remember what happened and they're going to consider that it could happen again, that another Trump-like figure or a figure with similar policies comes to power.
Speaking of a Trump-like figure, let's quickly change the subject to Elon Musk in our last few minutes. I mean, this has been a wild week, and now the SEC has opened an investigation.
Yeah, I mean, this all revolves around Elon Musk's surprise announcement, which turned out to be not true, that he was going to, quote unquote, take the company private.
Tesla,
his corporation Tesla. He would be taking it private. Daniel, just explain for the audience, what does it mean to take a company private?
Well, before we, and just let's say, when he said he was going to take it private, stock prices went way up. Then he changed his mind. He said, man, I'm not taking it private. And the stock prices plummeted. A lot of people, or some people, lost a lot of money. Maybe other people made some money.
Yeah. So taking a company private in this case meant that Tesla was already public, which means it's publicly traded on an open market like the stock exchange. So you can go to a broker like Charles Schwab or Fidelity and buy shares in Tesla, his company. By taking it private, what he's saying is he's taking it away from that open market so that it's not open to just everyone to buy, and it's only open to private investors that ultimately have to be approved by the board and by Elon Musk to buy. The reason why this matters is what he said is that he would be buying, taking it private and buying back those shares at a huge premium. The shares would be a good chunk of money over their current value. So naturally, that caused a lot of people to get excited and start investing in it. I think, and I want to say this is a speculation, Elon Musk had been trying very hard to secure more funding. Tesla was burning through a tremendous amount of money and really not meeting the production goals that it had set. And he needed more cash, but he was having a lot of trouble getting it. He then reported that he was going to take the company private. He also lied about saying he secured private funding. He didn't, but he said he did on Twitter. There's this huge influx of capital because now everyone thinks they're going to get rich. And then, it turns out he didn't secure that funding. And now, nope, just kidding, never mind. And so that money that flowed in is now flowing out. But for a period of time, he had secured this additional revenue stream that he was looking after. Now, I'm not saying he did this intentionally. He lied to get people's money because obviously I don't have special access to him. But it does look very suspicious to me. And the SEC tends to agree in that they are currently investigating him because if you say that you have secured funding when you have in fact not, that is a crime, and a lot of investors, speaking of investors' bills of rights, get very upset about that because they've been hoodwinked by Elon Musk. So we'll see what the SEC uncovers or discovers, but there's a lot of very wealthy people that are upset about this.
Yeah, I'm looking at the CNBC story. Elon Musk's hubris after his now infamous tweet about possibly taking Tesla private could come back to haunt him with regulators. Former Securities and Exchange Commission attorney Teresa Goody told CNBC on Monday the Tesla co-founder and CEO abandoned the idea late Friday, just weeks after he took to Twitter on August 7th, writing, quote, he's considering taking Tesla private at $420 per share, adding, quote, funding secured. A little over a week after his original tweet, Musk gave an unapologetic interview to the New York Times, and he also said he doesn't plan to stop tweeting. Just out of curiosity, I mean, the people who were friends of Elon Musk, and maybe Elon Musk himself, we don't know, if they knew that his announcement, his tweet that he was considering taking it private would drive stock prices up, might they not have purchased a lot of that stock right before the announcement? And if they knew a week later that he was going to say, oh, sorry, didn't have the funding, not going to take it private, that they could also be selling stock, again, because of basically insider information or manipulation?
Yeah, it's absolutely possible. And really, intent doesn't matter. So if you had access to that information, even if your intent wasn't to take advantage of it, but you did sell or you did have futures or you did engage in transactions from which you profited, that's a crime. And so that's a big part of what they're looking into as well, because you have these very elite circles. They chat over drinks. They share their thoughts on different things. And then, you can take advantage of that special information. So that's a big part of what the SEC is looking into now.
Yeah, it's a new era, Walter, where somebody like Trump or Musk tweet, they know it's going to have an impact because they're playing the media. And it's going to drive stocks up or drive stocks down, and they know it in advance.
Yeah, it's a growing trend too of people who are themselves big businessmen getting directly involved in politics, like as politicians, as elected officials. Of course, Donald Trump is the president, but on the other side, on the Democratic Party side, there's lots of different possible 2020 contenders who are big businessmen themselves. Howard Schultz of Starbucks being one of them. Daniel, is it actually possible to enforce insider trading laws in any sort of meaningful way when you're in a social political landscape like this?
It's extremely difficult, nearly impossible. I mean, the SEC has been hobbled in so many different ways and has lost funding in so many different ways that it really isn't able to effectively go after these things. It takes something as blatant as, you know, a Twitter storm by Elon Musk for it to, you know, be able to have a really substantial investigation. There are many things it could do to prevent insider trading. There are many things it can put in place additionally. But the problem is with the lack of funding and with legislation that in many ways ties its hands and requires a long bureaucratic process to open up cases, it really limits the power of the SEC. So, you know, if you're a wealthy investor, it's, you know, a very calculated risk to engage in a little insider trading. I mean, how is the SEC going to know about a conversation you had over drinks with Elon Musk at his house one night? You know what I mean? It's a hard thing to prove. And the legislation is really in their favor. So, you know, this sort of stuff is extremely common. It happens once in a while, and then it hits the papers and everybody reads about it. And it sounds like, oh, this is some kind of uncommon scandal that the, you know, cops are going after now. But the truth is it happens constantly, and they're really underfunded to be able to go after it in a meaningful way.
You know, Daniel Sankey, I want to thank you. And I know John Kiriakou, Walter, Nicole, the whole team here at Loud and Clear want to thank you because, again, just to say for our audience, the big economic and financial issues of the day, whether they're coming from Wall Street or from the government, impact all of us. And just like the investor state dispute resolution courts exclude the people from any decision making, so does the media. It's written by and for financial policy analysts like yourself. But you, on this segment, on this show, help the audience actually understand what the issues are. They're not that complicated. We can take the mystique off of them. We can help people understand, not just so that we understand, but so that we can act, that we can do something about it. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He joins Loud and Clear every Tuesday in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.